the topics that I have, I only have three, Joe, so if you schedule another one, just I don't need to really know ahead, but I need to set time aside. The topics that I chose on the schedule are, it keeps getting better, and I'll talk about that for the next, what, till 10? Are we 5 of 10 we'll try to end?
Yeah.
Okay. And then the traditions. I did ask for that. I will dress a little funny for the traditions. And then the steps in service work, and sort of where that has played into my recovery story. And my sobriety date is August 2nd, 1988, for which I'm never sufficiently grateful. And so I've been coming to SA and meetings and working the program as best I'm able for 16 years. And I always have to do the math. 3 months and 11 days, but who's counting? And as a consequence, there's an awful lot of, you know, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now to share. Although, of course, the what it was like hasn't changed one iota since I came in. And for that, I'm never sufficiently grateful either. And it's really in the what happened that it keeps getting better comes in. So I'm going to start sort of in the middle and then go backwards and then forward. On August night of August 1st, 1988, my wife had a nervous breakdown somewhere between 10 o'clock and midnight. I don't remember the exact time. I do remember that she had seen me at noon that day going out to lunch with a woman. She assumed I was having an affair with that woman. She was actually wrong about that particular woman. And she couldn't take it anymore. And she was screaming at me and just falling apart. I was sitting in a blue velvet high back chair that's still in our living room. And I know the kids were home, and I don't know why that wasn't a factor, but I don't know where the kids were, but I know where she and I were, where Jane and I were. And she was getting louder and louder, and I was getting quieter and quieter. And 2 weeks before, we had started seeing a therapist, and that, as I've said last night, was a consequence of my wife telling a woman in the church whose husband had multiple affairs, that they had been seeing this counselor. So we went to see her. And whatever kind of work my wife had been doing to control what she knew and what she did with what she knew had ended right there in front of me. I didn't understand that at the time. All I understood was she was freaking out. But more importantly, for me, it turned out, and I didn't know this for a while, of course, as I sat there and got quieter and quieter, I was realizing that I had nothing to say. I was not acting out with that one woman, but the woman that I'd been having an affair with the previous year, and then we had broken it off in December because I was suicidal and I went to a therapist because I didn't really want to die, and I ended the affair. And then about 3 months, right after that, my wife and I went on a 4.5 month trip together. And I really had gone off with this wondering, you know, could she and I be together that long and be okay? And we had one of our kids with us. Actually, it was wonderful. It was a wonderful time. There was only one minor break in the wonderfulness of that trip. She found the list of women to whom I was sending postcards as we were on this trip, all of whom I had affairs with. And she freaked out, and she was really upset, and to put it mildly. And my wife's a redhead, and every stereotype about redheads is pretty accurate with her. And she had made me write goodbye letters to all of them. One of them I even had to call back to my office and get the address because I didn't have it. And this woman had been one of them, and then she penned, I'm sure, a very ugly postscript to each letter. She didn't let me see it, and off they went. Well, I was just so relieved. This was in April, and or maybe, yeah, April. And I was, you know, finally, I was going to stop the affairs. I wasn't going to do that anymore. I was masturbating regularly on the trip, but that didn't, you know, that wasn't a problem. And all the women now that I had had any ongoing connections with, she knew about, and we had done the letter bit. And so we finished up the trip after she got through the raw pain, really delightfully, and we had a wonderful time. And it was clear we were a compatible couple, and I was finished with the affairs, and then got back to work, and had been back at work about a month and a half, and things had really gone fine. And the woman that I had the last affair with, over whom I was suicidal, contacted me and wanted to have lunch. Well, I couldn't say no because she could blackmail me, right? And so we had lunch, and she said she wanted to resume the affair. And I was absolutely petrified. And in fact, that's what had happened within a week of when we saw that therapist for the first time in July. And I didn't know what to do because I knew that I would resume the affair. And I knew that it would end my marriage, it would end my career. And I just was desperate. And yet, it was desperate, like desperate in the middle of a river going over a big waterfall. You know. And so that was all what was leading up immediately to August 1st, 1988. And as I sat there in that chair, I didn't have any answers. I had no clever ideas. I had no witty comebacks. I was just out. About 6 years ago, I was working with a wonderful therapist, and I was not raised with the capacity to handle strong emotions. And so I would sometimes stuff them, but more often for me, I would dump them. And I would dump them by going into lust fantasies and going into sexual acting out. And as he and I worked on all this stuff, of course, the obvious question is, well, okay, David, are you any better at handling emotions? And one day he was really pushing on me about my feelings, and I couldn't talk. I was just speechless, and I started laughing after about 3 minutes. And I said, Steve, that's it. When I am having emotions, I can't talk. I talk for a living. I talk at SA. I talk all the time. When I'm having feelings, I am literally speechless. And that has been such a gift for me to realize that when I'm speechless, it means that I am in touch with my whole self in a way that it's very difficult for me to be. Well, that night, August 1st, I was in touch with myself in a whole way. It was very difficult to do. I was speechless. I didn't know any of that thing about feelings then. But it turned out to be my bottom. And the next day, we saw this therapist, and she met with each of us. And while I was meeting with her, I guess I just had to be involved with more than one woman sexually at a time. And she just said casually, as I shared last night, that, well, you're a sex addict. And there's a book some of you may have read called I Heard the Owl Call My Name. And it just lays out the idea that when we are called by our true names, we will know it. And that's exactly what happened to me that afternoon, is I was called by my true name for the first time. And I knew it. I look back now and realize what a miracle it was that I knew it and accepted it. But at the time, it was just a relief. And I knew a little bit about sexual addiction. I guess I may have known more than I let on. In our white book, in Roy's story, he talks about the issue of Time magazine that came out in July of 1974. About the new addictions and about that maybe sex is an addiction. And he read that article, and that was part of what set him on the way to AA. When I got the white book, at that time it was 8.5 by 11. And when I got the white book and read that line, I sort of just started laughing and my heart stopped at the same time. I still have that issue of Time magazine in my files. I had saved it the week it came out, and I always knew where it was. I know where it is today. I guess there's a part of me that knew 14 years at that point before that I was going to need that article and going to need what came from that article, which is Sexaholics Anonymous. But I didn't know any of that back then. What I did know was that when she said I was a sex addict, I knew she was right. I went to my first meeting that night, and as I shared last night, I heard people talking about masturbation as being their core problem, and I knew instantly that was it, because I had started masturbating when I was 10 years old. I had tried to stop when I was 13. I was now 42. I had not tried to stop since then. I had masturbated throughout my marriages, and it more or less kept it a big secret. I remember my first wife, I kept telling her, I have this big secret. And then after we were married 2 or 3 years, for some reason I told her what it was. And she didn't care. You know, it didn't impress her at all. Of course, by that time we had both started having other affairs, so that might have been part of it. But, you know, it wasn't a secret that affected anybody else. It was my secret, and my secret waters. And then with my current wife, I used to say to her, you know, it's not the other women that are the real problem. And that was true, because what I knew was I was mostly attached to the fantasy women in my head. And they were far more serious. I was taunting her is what I was doing, but and I'm not proud of that. But I was saying, you know, the real women you have to worry about aren't the ones that walk around in flesh and blood. In fact, they're kind of inconvenient when you get right down to it, because they have reactions and call you and things like that. But anyway, I went to that meeting and heard about masturbation, and I knew that that was the truth for me, that I had not been able to stop for 28 years at that point, and that I knew enough about AA. I'm not an alcoholic yet, but I've been around, for professional reasons, been around AA for many years, and I knew what drunks report about the effect of their first drink. And when I heard that masturbating and the sexual acting out was like getting drunk, I identified immediately, because I can remember to this second exactly what happened, what it was like when I first, you know, discovered masturbation, and what was going on in my head and what was going on in my body. And I have no doubt. I can trace the sexual addiction from a lot earlier than that, but in terms of the masturbation, I was totally smashed and hooked on the first drink, and was never free to stop after that. Didn't mean I did it every day, almost every day, but not quite. But even on the days I wasn't actually masturbating, I was planning it or remembering it. It was never out of my mind, and I've always identified with the AA stories because of that. The meeting also put me with a group of guys who it was working, and I called the phone line. I didn't learn for a long time what an amazing thing this was. I called the phone line and left my number and got home. We left the therapist's office and went home, and the phone rang, and it was a guy calling me to tell me about meetings. After that, I learned it sometimes takes days, weeks, maybe never, to get a call back from the phone line. But I actually got mine within an hour and went to my first meeting that same day. My first sponsor was the guy who called me back and who met me at the meeting. I was terrified at the first meeting. But, you know, God works in funny ways. Many people's worst fear, I don't know if it would have been my worst fear, but it would have been one of them, is that you go to the meeting and someone knows you. And my first meeting, there was a guy who knew me, and I knew him. I knew him because he'd been on the front page of the paper when he was arrested. And I knew he'd gone off to Golden Valley. And so I wasn't too surprised to see him there. We knew each other professionally. Years later, he told me he wasn't surprised to see me either, and that pissed me off. But, you know, the delusions die hard. And John went on to start SAA in Nashville, which is going very well, and he's done a lot of good work. And for many years, we'd come back annually and get his chip, and it's always been a special person for me. My sponsor and I worked the steps and got through step five. Took about 9 months. Somebody said something, I don't know if it was in a meeting or last night, can't remember, it doesn't matter, about working the steps. There are different sort of ways, I was going to say schools of thought, that's not true, but there are different ways of doing it. And I'm grateful. Well, first of all, I'm grateful that I got sober in Nashville, which, as I said last night, we had 6 meetings a week. That was just the max number of meetings in the world at that point in one area. We added a 7th later on. But so on the 7th, I would go to SAA initially. But the people who had started SAA in Nashville were AA big book fanatics, AA fanatics. So we were very, very close to AA, and to this day I can be in an AA meeting or an SA meeting or equally comfortably, because that's how I came in. But another thing was, for many people in AA, the deal is work the steps. Like, why wait? Do it, you know, and don't mess around and don't put it off. And we do, of course, do a written first step, and that's different from AA, but the sentiment there was, if you're serious about this program, do your first step. And I'll tell you about my second and third step in a minute. So I did. I started writing my first step on powerlessness and unmanageability. My sponsor said, just whatever is in your head about the powerlessness over lust and sex and unmanageability of your life caused by that, put it down. And then I shared it at a meeting. I've been sober about 3 weeks, and took 2 meetings, as it turned out, to do that. I remember looking around. We were in a conference room at a big table, and there was barely space between the table and the wall for the chairs, and we were all around. It was about a third women and two-thirds men. And I just remember when I first started being so ashamed that I was going to share all this stuff and in public, and I was a reasonably public person anyway, so it was kind of a problem in my mind, and I looked around and I thought, you know, but wait a minute, they're at an SA meeting, you know, they don't want people to know they're at an SA meeting any more than I want to know. And so I kind of got over it, and I think, you know, if I had waited any longer, that would have become a bigger deal to me. I know people in my kind of occupation who won't go to regular meetings because someone will know me. As I said, that got taken care of right away. Or that people can't know this about me. And I think one of the advantages for me of doing my first step so quickly was that none of that had gelled yet. I was still in raw pain. I wanted to get out of the pain. This was the way out. Work 1 through 12, that's the way out. So I did it. And that was the other thing. I had enough exposure to AA to know I had to do what I was told, that my brain had gotten better, so it wasn't my brain that was going to get me, you know, any differently. And I really believed that. And so I was told to do my first step, so I did it. And I laid out a lot of stuff. I thought of some things later that I hadn't shared, but it wasn't a lot, but many. It was during one of those, the second session, I was just sitting at the table, and I guess I was talking, and I suddenly saw one of the women in the room lying nude on the table in front of me. I mean, she was really there. It was rather unsettling. And I realized I'd had an hallucination. And that was my first sign of conscious hallucination. But I had lived my life in hallucinations at that point for over 25 years, so it wasn't exactly a big surprise. But I added it to my contract the next morning. I surrendered my right to hallucinate. Another thing that happened in addition to doing my first step was, and as I shared last night, I offered to share with my wife, and mercifully she said, the hell you will. Later on, my sponsor convinced me, my second sponsor, my first sponsor left the program, convinced me that one of the most powerful teaching tools God uses is humiliation, and one of God's favorite forms of humiliation, Harvey, many of you know him, Harvey said, was you have to sit in your own shit, David. The stink of your own shit. He always had a flair for graphic language. And that's what, essentially, my wife, she didn't know what she was doing, but that's what she allowed me to do, was to sit in the stink of my own shit. And when I have pushed the boundaries of this sobriety and this program over the years, that comes back to me, you know? I can't dump it. I can't make myself feel better at someone else's expense. The book, actually, both the big book and 12 and 12 put it at that. What I have to do is sit in the stink of my own crap and just, you know, learn from that. And over the years, there is a pattern of God using humiliation as his primary teaching tool over and over and over again. And to the point where, when it happens now, more often than not, I'm just grateful for it, because I know something important is going to happen. Last week, I had a situation where someone shared something, a couple actually shared something really powerful with me. And I found myself a little bit later sharing it with my wife, and I was humiliated afterwards. There was no need to. She didn't really want to know it. And I'd broken confidentiality, of course, and I just felt crappy, literally. And I realized that it was humiliation, that I had violated professional canons, but more importantly, violated who I needed to be. And I thought, why am I doing that? And I thought, oh, because what they told me was so awful, and I was feeling all these emotions, and I dealt with them the way I've always dealt with emotions. You know, I just did a go off on some explosive stream. In this case, it didn't happen to be acting out sexually. And then what my sponsor taught me was, not only did I have to sit in the sink of my own shit, I have to say, God, I made a mistake. Help me not make that mistake again. And then let go of it. And, you know, it's much easier to hold on to it, to beat myself up to say how terrible I am. Anything's easier than saying, God, I made a mistake. Help me not make that mistake again. And to accept that I not only make mistakes, and I have to live with the consequences of them, but that the person who's going to help me not make that mistake again is my higher power. It's not me. I do it, and it worked fine, by the way. So I did my first step. I went to do my second step, and my sponsor said, well, I'm going to do with you what I was done with me. And I said, okay. And he said, do you believe that a power greater than yourself can restore your sanity? I said, yes. And I didn't know about God stuff. I'll come to that in a minute. And he said, are you willing to work steps 4 through 12? And I said, yes. And he said, good, so start your fourth step. And I was devastated, because I had this whole mental routine built up on how I was going to challenge steps 2 and 3. And that little turkey took me right through them. And I had no, I mean, what could I do? I was supposed to do my fourth step. And it was, and the background for that is I was raised an atheist. That was fine. That was my parents, and that's what I was. But when I came into 12-step program, I knew this God stuff was going to be a real problem. And yet I realized also that God didn't appear in the steps till step 3, so I thought, well, I've got a break here. It's so much pain and so much fear and so much at stake. I didn't want to lose another marriage, another set of kids. As I said, I would have lost my occupation. I just didn't want to go through that again. So I just did the first step. And by the way, the first month, the first 30 days, I was so glad for the invention of Advil. I just had phenomenal amounts of pelvic congestion. And I knew that's what women did for their pelvic congestion, so I tried it for mine, and it worked just fine. And then I also ended up taking a naturopathic kind of antidepressant, which in my case turned out to be very helpful. It was also removed from the market about 6 months later. It's never been put back on. So I guess I came through lucky on that one, too. But it's given me a respect not only was there physical pain when I got sober, but I'd worked with enough people dealing with alcoholism that I knew when they got sober, they always were massively depressed. So I thought, and correctly as it turned out, when I got sober, I was going to be massively depressed, which I was. And understandably, when you start thinking about what you've done and consequences and all that kind of stuff, it's reasonable to be depressed about it. And so I was glad to took the edge off. And I've always been one of those people that supports people, using antidepressants in that time for that reason. because it was so helpful to me. So I was suddenly on step four and began working on that. That took about 8 or 9 months to finish. I would work on it for a while and then put it aside. And I started off using a Hazelden workbook, which was okay. It was actually, I've been grateful for that. But when I finished the workbook, I realized that I had to use the page 65 format from the AAB book if I was really going to do the fourth step that worked. I think my sponsor may have said something along that line, too. But in any case, I did that. And I've been eternally grateful for that because they're very different. And the AA fourth step has the side advantage of being far easier than any other fourth step you'll run into, at least based on my survey of what's available. And I am kind of lazy, so that was good. And so it had the fourth step format, it turned out for me, and people I've used it with since, has these two features. It's more effective and it's less difficult. And it seems to me that's kind of a winning combination. So, but I know a lot of people don't do that. So I just lay out what works for me and what I passed on to others. I'd been sober a year. My sponsor, right after my fifth step, left the program. I never took it personally, but I did kind of miss him. But in that point, I had started calling him less and less often and got down probably once a month. And he finally, in one phone call, said he was not going to be coming to meetings anymore. And that was July. I was coming up on my year. I was pretty panicky. We had good sobriety, and we now had 7 meetings a week by then. We were planning an international conference that was coming up in January the next year. And that would be my first international. So there was stuff I was doing that was fine and helping, and I was reasonably sober. But it was still, I didn't have a sponsor. And when it came up to my 1 year, my person who was to become my sponsor gave me a 1 year birthday card. And I don't do it every time, and yet it was so important to me, I like to do it whenever I do it because it made such a difference. Because he wrote in the card, congratulations on your 1 year. And then he said, the one thing I promise you, David, is that emotions. The one thing I promise you is that it will keep getting better. He had 3.5 years at that point. He was one of the grand old sages in AA. At that point, with 3.5 years, or 4 years maybe, he was right in there. And I needed to know that. That I didn't know how much I needed to know it. But it turned out that I think a part of me probably was losing hope. After all, my sponsor had left, and I was up on character defects and 8th and 9th step. The program, in a way, I wasn't going to daily meetings, but I was probably going 5 to 6 times a week right then. My sponsor went to 2 meetings a day, except on good days, and then he went to 3 meetings a day. So that was the model being set for me. Not the sponsor who left the program, but he became my sponsor. But I think that it keeps getting better really was exactly the right message for me at that time. And in many ways has become my theme. That's why I titled the talk this way. Because that has been true. It was already true. My marriage had not fallen apart. I was, in fact, still sober. That first year was long. 90 days, 30 days was bad. 90 days was really, really bad. 6 months was fine. 9 months is when I did my fifth step, so it may have been bad, but since I was doing my fifth step right in there, it kind of just went through. 1 year, I'd always heard that right leading up to 1 year is pretty hard. It was also, of course, the anniversary of realizing I was going to act out again with that woman. It was the anniversary of my wife confronting me. And it was tough. It was just really pretty raw. And didn't really want to act out sexually at all, that I remember. But I just remember it was pretty crazy. I found out, there are phases in sobriety, and we don't talk about it a lot, although it's actually in the AAB book and it's in our white book too. And that is, when we first get sober, there's just the physical reality of it and the awareness of how much we're lusting, you know, how much it consumed me, in my case. And getting through, and that's one reason I don't want to act out again. I don't want to go through that first 30 days again. It was awful. And then there's this depression and just, gloom and doom and all that kind of stuff. And also this total fear of losing my sobriety. I mean, just mind-consuming fear. I've always been grateful to SAA for many reasons. They were my Sunday night meeting, for one thing. And secondly, one Sunday I was getting ready to go out to the meeting, and I leaned against the sink and felt the sink against my penis, and it just terrified me, and I was a raw sort of quivering piece, and I went out to the meeting, and I said in the meeting, I got to talk. I just leaned against the sink, and it really stimulated me, and it was just awful. And this old guy, a long-time AA guy, had a cigarette voice, and he said, "You'll get over it." And of course, I had to laugh. And you know, I did. I got over it. I've been leaning against the sink a lot since then. Not deliberately. That's the thing. I'd never forgotten that. That I'll get over it. And that's been true with almost everything. Not only does it get better, anything that's disturbing me, I'll get over it if I don't act out. And that's the big caveat, of course. But that had changed. At 90 days, I gave up fighting God. I came in an atheist. It was a tremendous advantage for me. I didn't know it at the time. I thought it was a liability. That was going to be a problem. I was really, as I said, dreading that third step. How was I going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as we understand Him? My sponsor, as I said, just got me right past that so fast I didn't know what happened. And I did my fourth step. But at a little over 90 days, I was taking a shower one day. And showers are pretty dangerous places for me. So I was praying continuously in the shower. And all of a sudden, it hit me that I didn't have to know what God was or wasn't. The only thing I had to know was I praying or not? And I was quite willing to pray. And I had funny names for God, Master, Teacher, Spirit, whatever. But I realized I could just resign from the debating society. And I did that day. And I didn't pick it up again. And I've been so grateful for that. And that's I guess, I was just ready to get that gut-level feeling that the nice thing about this program, and this has not changed one iota in 16 years, is that it doesn't matter whether I believe it or not. It's convenient if I believe it, but it doesn't matter. If I do it, it'll work. And if I don't do it, it won't work. I tell people the most important words I hear in any SA meeting are the last words we say. It works if you work it. That's it. That's the entire program. Well, it's not the program. That's how to do it. Whether I believe in it, whether I think it's going to work, whether I trust it, whether I can see the changes in myself, none of that matters. What does matter is that I do it or don't do it. If I don't do it, it's very predictable too. But that happened in 90 days. When I had been sober, I guess it was 8 or 9 months, so I said 9 months wasn't a problem, I think I probably lied. What did happen, it wasn't a struggle with the program per se, or sobriety. What did happen right in there was I had a 2 or 3 week period, 2.5 weeks, something in there, it was in March of 1989, in which I totally lost contact with God. And I couldn't make it happen. And I was absolutely petrified. I talked about it with my sponsor. By that time, I had gotten my new sponsor, and I'll go back to him in a second. No, I hadn't. I still had my old sponsor. I talked about my sponsor, but that's right. I wasn't talking to him very often. That didn't help any. I was talking about it at meetings. I was writing gratitude lists every day. It was on all my gratitude lists. But I had I didn't have the contact. I lost that sense that I could turn my will and my life over to God, as I understood. It was excruciatingly lonely and painful. It was the first time I'd felt alone since I'd been in the program. And I was just panicked. And I suppose it was the meetings and my 2B sponsor was in all the meetings, of course, but I realized that if I didn't lose my sobriety, whatever this was going on would change. And after about 2.5 weeks, it did change. And I reconnected. And probably not incidentally, I had stopped working on my fourth step for about a month and a half. And I started working on my fourth step again. Funny thing about that, taking action stuff. And I would reconnected. And actually, I've never lost that connection since. That's another thing I don't want to go back through again, because that was awful. At the same time, it ended. And somewhere a number of years ago, I realized that one of the things I have to hold on to is that the way it is today is not the way it's always going to be. And I can repeat that in my head as often as I want, because it's the truth, and it's often the only thing that will get me through a given situation. Because I always want to catastrophize. Whatever the way it is now is the way, the awfulness now is the awfulness forever. And I do the opposite. Actually, the goodness now is the goodness forever. And neither one's true. The way it is today is not the way it's always going to be. And I didn't consciously know that during that experience, but I started living it, and that was probably more important. Well, in August, I did get a new, after the 1 year, I did get a new sponsor. He said, you will call me every day. We set a time, 7:30. And I called him every day for 7 years at 7:30. Sometimes I was in Europe, Canada, all over the United States, Mexico. I called him at 7:30 every day. And he was always available at 7:30 because I had the 7:30 slot. And that's how we worked it. I probably would miss sometimes, you know, we literally were on the road and I just couldn't get to the phone until late in the afternoon or something. It cost a fair amount of money at times. But, you know, compared to what I spent on my disease and compared to the amount of money I would and you know, lost in terms of my occupation and other things, the divorces, it was nothing. And I've always, when it's money or time, just like anybody else in the program, I can get on my high horse about it. Oh, that's too expensive. I remember one retreat about a year and a half ago we had. What's the cost of this retreat? What did you guys pay?
$140.
We were charging $150, $160. And a guy I sponsored was just, and his wife were just desperate. You know, they couldn't afford that much money. And I knew their financial situation was pretty tough. And so we arranged for them to get a scholarship. And then we arranged for them to get a scholarship and another scholarship. And they ended up both coming basically for free. And about 3 or 4 days after the conference, they bought a $1,000 riding lawnmower to replace the one they had that they didn't like anymore. And that was a wonderful reminder to me that coming to SA, retreats, coming to SA, doing things in the program, is the calling of sponsor from wherever I am, is never about money. We may say it is, you know, bullshit, you know. When you can spend $1,000 3 days later on something that, you know, the economy didn't even need. You know, and that's happened over and over. That just happened fairly recently, so it's still in my mind. And I had that willingness. I knew I needed to do it. I did my eighth step with him, Harvey, sixth and seventh. He had me write a list of my character defects. My next sponsor, Jess, had me do the same. And I still carry them in my date book. I look at them periodically. And I don't really need to look at them because I realized after a period of time there's a very nice thing about my character defects. And that is they change as much as my eye color changes. And I was born with blue eyes, and to this day I still have blue eyes as best I know. And I was born with the same character defects, 59 years ago that I have today. Or maybe I acquired a few along the way, it doesn't matter. The fact is, they're mine, and I can either act like I don't have them, or just say they're part of me. And that's sort of what 6 and 7 became for me, and still are. Doesn't mean I don't have to be entirely ready to let them go, and it doesn't mean I have to humbly ask God to do it. It just means that they're just me, and it's asking God to take care of these parts of me that are holes in my soul, people sometimes say, or weak spots, or, I have a known blind spot. When I'm looking straight ahead, right over here, there's a blind spot, and I have nearly had car wrecks quite a few times because of that. And so when I come to a stop sign, I've learned that I have to do the bobblehead thing, like those little dolls with the swinging necks, If I do this, I'll be fine, because it compensates for the blind spot. Yesterday in the airport, when I came up, I didn't have very long, because Steve found me right away, but even being with Steve, it didn't affect the fact that my scanner was on, and I was scanning body parts. And airports are wonderful supplies of body parts. And so my equivalent of the bobbling in the airport, I can't bobble safely, so I either study the floor, which I'm really good at, but I have this wonderful gift, you all just vanished, you're no problem for me anymore. And so I took my glasses off, and I'd taken them off on the plane when I started looking across the aisle, and I took them off in the Portland airport, I took them off, I take them off a lot, actually. And that's the thing about my character defects, is I can't do anything about them. God can, I can. And he has this... I decided I have a really... what's the word when you're needy for attention? My God is really weak-willed. He needs constant attention. And so what my God likes to do is mess me up so that I pay attention to him. Well, I cooperate. And so I get constant reminders that you need to, surrender and let go and let God. And that's what my character defects are. So he leaves them around because they're useful to him, because he likes the attention. So he doesn't take them away, really. He just kind of makes them so they don't run my life anymore. And in return, he gets the attention. So that's our deal. My 8th and 9th step I did with Harvey and did my amends. And I'm going to wind up pretty quickly here, but one of the amends was to a woman I've worked with who... retired right about the time I did my 5th step, right about 10 months, 11 months sobriety. When I did my amends to her, she was the only one who actually didn't accept it. And she wrote back and said something kind of obnoxious. My sponsor said, David, your amends was done when the letter hit the mailbox, because she was in England. And she did whatever she did. But in a way, she gave me a great gift because... she wrote back and said, I hope I never work for as angry a person again. And it really stunned me because I'm a very nice, pleasant, thoughtful, responsive, kind of guy. And I did not like being told that I was one of the angriest people she had ever worked for. And it was true. It was true because she retired. And one of the phases of getting sober after the depression is the rage. And Roy writes that actually very eloquently about the rage. And I was in it while she was there, and then she left. So the fact that it got better, she didn't see. And it's a reminder that when I'm meeting someone who's in that, I just met someone yesterday or day before, who's in that stage, that it's part of sobriety. It's actually a compliment. Two things that complement sobriety that we think are kind of nervous. One is the rage. It's not pleasant, and it's not a good idea to direct it where you want to direct it, but it's part of getting sober. The other thing is sexually explicit dreams. I never have sexually explicit dreams I'm acting out. They only happen when we're sober. And it's the same in AA and NA, by the way, too. And that's been very helpful. But just like my bad vision, I have terrible vision. I have really serious astigmatism. I have bad nearsightedness. For many years, I thought it was a problem. Turns out it's one of the greatest gifts that I've ever been given. because I need to take my glasses off. I feel really sad for people who have normal vision. You guys have to work so much harder, you know. And it was the same way with my atheism. It turned out to be the greatest gift I could have had coming into this program, because I had never been disappointed by God. I had never reached out to God and said, you know, get me out of this mess, and God didn't do it. Because there wasn't any God, so I never did that. So I had no baggage to unwind. All I had to do was make God as I understand him. I had to let go of my mother and father's God, which was atheism, and pick up a God that worked for me. I thought that was a problem. It was a gift. Everything that in my sobriety and recovery that I thought was a problem has turned out to be a gift, and the opposite is pretty much true too. The things I thought were assets turned out to be problems. I have, despite the blind spot, I have really good peripheral vision. I always thought that was a real asset. I have really good hearing. I always thought that was a real asset. But that means that I can see body parts at an immense radius, and I can hear high heels 500 yards off on grass, you know. And that's, you know, so the stuff I thought was great, yeah, and the stuff I thought was a problem turns out to be an asset. To this day, I tell people, and they think I'm joking, and I'm not. If I'm facing some situation and I don't know what to do, one of my best strategies is really to sit down, write it out, be very thoughtful about it, come up with my best solution, and then do the exact opposite. And it works. It's really reliable. The likelihood that I will simply... I've gotten to a point now with my wife where if I start getting negative about someone and I'll share something to her, I realize that I'm probably just flat-ass wrong, and often before the end of the sentence. And it's really taken away a lot of craziness in my life. That's only the first year. My sponsor was right. First year and a half. My sponsor was right. It just keeps getting better. My willingness to accept who I truly am, my willingness to accept who people are in this program, my willingness to accept this program. I do a lot of service work, and as a consequence, I've been in the middle of some of our rather tedious, to me, battles over the last 16 years. And at the same time, because of the first tradition and the second tradition and all the traditions, really, I've always known that the most important thing is for Sexaholics Anonymous to be healthy, for me to be a member of Sexaholics Anonymous. And, everything else is secondary. It's God's business anyway. I don't have to stick my nose in it. And so the ability to go through situations. I did lose my career for a while because I broke my anonymity in public a lot. That turned out to be really dumb. If anybody's thinking of doing that, consult with me. I'll save you some trouble. So I figured that my addiction cost me a somewhat amount of money before I got sober and cost me about $125,000 after. And then I'm back in it, back in the career. So the way it is today is not the way it's always going to be. It turns out to be true. The last thing I want to share is what we started with. Today was the third step prayer. Sorry to run over here. When I came in to SA and discovered the third step prayer, it really kind of jarred me. Because in 1982, 6 years before I came in, a woman came to see me for professional reasons, and I ended up giving her a card. She needed Al-Anon really bad. And I went to an AA meeting, but they had some Al-Anon literature. And I got her some Al-Anon literature, and they had a little card that had the Serenity Prayer on one side and the Third Step Prayer on the other. I started an affair with that woman. And I was desperate, and I really, it was 1980, it wasn't 82, 1980. I started an affair with that woman, and I really didn't know what to do. I was in a lot of pain about it. I was going to devastate my family. And I was an atheist, right? So I snuck into a church in the middle of the night, turned on just enough lights so I could read, but damn good, I didn't want to be caught. And I got down on my knees. The last time I had done that was 14 years before when I got married, and the minister said I had to. My father, by the way, was appalled that I did that during that wedding. And I got down on my knees, and I had that card, and I read that third step prayer. I don't know, two or three times out loud. I think I even sort of tried to memorize it. I didn't know what I was doing, but what? I was just so desperate. And very shortly after that, I resigned the job, found a new job right away. It was actually miraculous. We moved, and I was out of that problem. Of course, I recreated the whole problem when I got where we lived next, but we're Nashville. But the third step prayer had been working for me long before I had any knowledge of SA or sobriety. And so when I came in, I did memorize it. It was real important to me. And actually, I made a mistake in memorizing it. Even the mistake became real important to me. It's a lesson about myself, because I reversed a couple of words. Instead of saying, "Thy power, thy love, and thy way of life," I had memorized it, "Thy love, thy power, and thy way of life." And I was standing in a meeting one day, and we were closing with the first step prayer. Everybody said, "Thy power, thy love, and thy way of life." And I went like this. And I thought, "Oh, I've got it wrong." And then I thought, "Oh, yeah, that's you. You want to be sure of the love before you accept the power. That's your thing, isn't it?" And it's very helpful. But anyway, I kept telling people that I sponsored to memorize the third step prayer. And some would, most wouldn't. And then about 5 years ago, across the whole continent, Canada and the United States, we started doing the third step prayer as a group all the time. And we started doing it in Portland, too. And that thing that I had thought was so important, and it is, it's just as important as it ever was. We're all doing it now, but not because I had anything to do with it. My yammering at people never made any difference. But suddenly everybody realized this is what God wants us to do. We're all going to do it. And so when we started with that today, it really gave me a sense of continuity and being at home, for which I'm never sufficiently grateful. Thanks.